Hello, everyone.
Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Sarah Lincoln. Sarah is the co-founder of her law firm, Lincoln Durr. She's at the helm of all practice groups for litigation and advising. She has earned a tenacious reputation in the courtroom, and she focuses her efforts on complex business and medical malpractice litigation. Sarah has earned many awards throughout the course of her career, but just to mention a quick few, she was voted Lawyer of the Year by Best Lawyers in 2015 and 2021. She's been voted a Top 50 Women's Attorney by Charlotte Magazine in 2019 and 2020, and she is a proud fellow of the American College of Trial Lawyers. I'm very excited to get into this conversation with Sarah today. I've been fortunate enough to have multiple conversations with her in the past, and I've always been struck by her strategic approach to asking questions, developing intelligence, working her way towards an outcome in a conversation, managing the situation that she's dealt with to the best of her ability, and forging relationships throughout the whole process. So I'm really excited to share as much as I can with what I've learned from her with everybody today. And just to give you an idea of the few things we're going to talk about, she's going to mention how important it is to consistently communicate as if you're always on the record. I was really fascinated by the conversation and the difference between good facts and bad facts, how you should approach both, and which you should often base your persuasive approach on. I really appreciated her approach to preparing witnesses. She also talked about the exhausting steps she goes to prepare herself and her team that we can all learn from. And she talks about the importance of knowing your own record. And that is just as true, in the boardroom as it is in the courtroom. Thank you all so much for being here again. I really appreciate you taking the time to listen to this episode. But before we get in, let's thank our sponsors really quick. We have HumanTel. If you haven't already, please head over to HumanTel.com. Read their research, read their blogs, check out their articles, and then choose whichever one of their training programs is best for you. If you've ever thought about developing the skill set of identifying what people are likely thinking and feeling at any moment in time by recognizing shifts in their emotion through their changing facial expressions and body language, then HumanTel is the place for you. Enter the code INCOASIVE25 for 25% off their best-in-class online training. I've done it myself. I highly recommend it. That's at HumanTel.com, and the code is INCOASIVE25. For the professional interviewers, please check out CertifiedInterviewer.com. That's where you can get all your questions answered on the International Association of Interviewers. That's where you can learn more about their networking opportunities, their interviewer resources, their online and in-person education events, everything that you have there from a team perspective and an individual perspective. That is also where you can learn more about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. What does it take to qualify? How do you pass the exam to earn the designation? How do you maintain it? What are the requirements? What could it mean for you in your career moving forward? All of that and more at CertifiedInterviewer.com. And while you're online, please check out INCOASIVE.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to customize for their senior leaders, business development teams, and HR professionals in order to teach them how to apply the strategic observation and persuasive communication techniques necessary to obtain the everyday confessions that lead us to forging relationships and achieving outcomes that have previously proved elusive. Thank you all so much for being here today. As always, I really appreciate you spending the next hour or so with us. So now, without further ado, Sarah Lincoln. Hello, Sarah. It is so great to see you again. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing very well. It has been way too long.
I know.
Thank you so much for taking the time. I'm really excited for this conversation.
Yeah, me too. And thanks for having me.
Oh, without a doubt. You had me on your show. So it's the least that I could do to have you here. But that aside, really, as I have an itch, I'm excited for this conversation because previous, just like side conversations we've had, we've nerded out on communication and questions and persuasion and rapport and all of these things. And so now I get to pick your brain a little bit on these topics. And I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity.
Looking forward to it.
So one of the things that we were talking about, honestly, just a couple of minutes ago, was the unique fact that so many of the conversations you and your team have are on the record. Like, essentially, all of them are on the record, unless it's a privileged conversation or it's your own team talking in meeting amongst each other. For the perspective of somebody outside of law and outside of the courtroom, how important do you think it is for leaders, for professional people, to essentially always communicate as if they're on the record?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's a bad way to approach conversations, particularly. I think what we were talking about was kind of critical conversations in particular, as if you were on the record, as if you're, every word you're saying is being recorded in some form or fashion. You know, it makes you really think about, or it should make you really think about exactly how those words are going to land, either for the person you're having the conversation with or for the people who are listening in on your conversation. So when I say that so many of our conversations are on the record, a lot of our conversations with witnesses are in front of juries or judges who are ultimately going to have to make a decision for us in the case that we're involved in. And so I have to think not only how is the way that I'm asking this question going to land with the person that I'm asking the question to make sure that I get the response that I want, but also if I get the response that I want, how is that going to be heard by the judge or the jury who's ultimately going to make the decision in the case? And I just, you know, I think that if people approached those types of critical conversations in the same way, they will end up hopefully with the result that they want, right? Like every conversation you have, if it's critical, you're probably having it because you want some particular result as coming out of that. So you should formulate those conversations just like you would if you were cross-examining a witness in front of a judge or a jury, even though not everybody's trained to do that.
And I think that's another great idea that we can come back to some of the, not that we're going to train everybody to do that, but some of those approaches and strategically how they line up. But I love how you illustrated there, considering how the words land, not just to the person who you're speaking and not just how they will react and they will respond and they will interpret, because there's a whole series of ripple effects there. How are they going to respond? How's their behavior yes. going to change? Inevitably, how are they going to twist your words? Those types of things. But also for the people that are observing. So in your case, it could be a jury. It could be a judge. It could be opposing counsel. If it's a deposition, there might be family members or somebody around. If it's a business context, is it coworkers? Is it somebody's direct manager? Is it somebody's family or friend? And of course, when they take the message home and the telephone game starts getting played, you know, how does that respond? You know, my wife being a human resources executive, really, for me, this thought process started evolving listening to her. Is like, okay, well, that's a really good point. If everything I say could come back in another fashion, whether it's legal, whether it's administrative, then I need to be really intentional. And I feel like it's also a great way to keep ourselves honest. Like, I'm staying on task. I'm staying to the point. I'm focusing on facts. And I'm willing to stand behind everything I say.
Willing to stand behind everything you say and having something that you can put in front of somebody that backs up everything you say. So one of the critical components for us when we're engaging in our form of conversations, which is usually us asking questions and getting answers back, I want to have a document or some other testimony or something to back up every question that I ask so that either I know the answer that I'm going to get is consistent with something that's already in writing or supported by some other form of evidence, or I may often ask a question to gather something that's inconsistent so that then I can smack a witness over the head with it and say, no, my friend, what you just said is inconsistent with a piece of evidence or some prior testimony or whatever to make the point that we're trying to make in that particular interaction.
That's a great example. You know, selfishly, in my previous investigative career, that was like plan A and plan B. Like plan A is I want the truth. But if it gets to the point where I realize the juice ain't worth the squeeze, I've got time, I've got limitations, I've got other factors, no problem. I'll switch. And plan B is to get this person to really confidently lock themselves into details that the empirical evidence I have is going to unequivocally disprove.
And correct.
They feel great about themselves, but the whole time they're just digging their own hole, and it gets us to the same conclusion either way.
Yeah, absolutely. But you've got to plan for that, just like you should plan for every critical conversation, you know?
And I know the planning component is very important to you in the detail in which you plan. And I was impressed in some of our previous conversations how it's not just like that strategic level, but sometimes like the amount of preparation you do to find one potentially random detail, statement, perspective, it's that needle in the haystack's the wrong way to look at it because it's not a random search. But we're going pouring through maybe mountains of information for just this little divot that's going to be the one piece that we can hinge this entire case or this entire argument on. How important is it for people to, this might be too big of a word, but exhaust all preparation options to make sure that they're locked into the best strategic approach?
Oh my gosh. We're somewhat limited in that exhaustive search by the fact that we have clients that pay us by the hour. So we have to be respectful, right, of how exhaustive we're going to be.
Sure.
But at the same time, you have to be exhaustive enough to find that thing if you need it, right? You don't need it in every single case. I just finished a trial with they only had one expert witness. That expert, his opinions weren't really consistent with what was in the available medical record, actually, that we had. So I didn't spend a ton of time digging to find the silver bullet that was just going to completely take that guy out. Mm-hmm. But in other cases, I really have. I've told this story probably on our podcast before, but I'll repeat it anyway. I had a case years ago with an expert who was a hard expert. Like, he was smart. He was engaging. He was going to make a good impression in front of the jury. His testimony against our client was absolutely damning. He was literally almost impossible to figure out how to cross-examine. And I was, the Sunday before trial started, just digging. And I called my law partner, Trisha. I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to do to get this guy. Like, what am I going to do? And I just kept reading and reading and reading things that he'd written. And all of a sudden, I noticed in each article that he had written, there was a disclaimer at the end about companies that he served on scientific advisory boards for and got paid for serving on those scientific advisory boards. And every single one of those companies, when I went and looked them up, it turned out manufactured the piece of equipment that he was contending that my client should have been using and didn't use during the performance of this surgical procedure that was being done. And then I looked and I saw that on his website for the university that he taught at, he also had to disclose that he had this financial interest in these companies. And I thought, well, wow, isn't that a bias? It's such a bias that the university has a policy on it that makes him put it on his website. And every journal article that he's published in requires him to disclose that bias, right? So that people will know. And so he sat there and he testified for, I don't know, like three and a half hours on direct examination with the plaintiff's attorney and never once made this disclosure. And so I started my cross-examination of him with that. And he was blown away. He was like, and then I called Trisha to figure out how to set it up because she loves the drama in the courtroom. And she's like, oh, ask him how long he's been there. Ask him when was he planning on making his disclosure. And he's going to be like, what are you talking about? And it was beautiful. But I dug and dug and dug on that guy because I didn't really have anything else to go on. But boy, that really paid off. The jury found in our favor. And after the trial, that expert sent my client a letter apologizing to him for having served as an expert witness against him and for any stress, anxiety, or concern it caused him and the members of his family. Because he realized himself that that was a bias that he had towards that piece of equipment. And, you know, it really wasn't about medical negligence. It was about his bias that put him in that position to give that testimony. So that, you know, it's worth it. It can be very worth it to dig.
Yeah. And it's a couple of details there, you know, that relentless pursuit of the silver bullet. Sometimes there really is nothing, but if you look hard enough, there's something you can use either fact, you know, whether it's just a perception, whether it's the fact, the presentation. Also love the work that you and Tricia did together on the presentation, because right. It's one thing to have it, but as you were talking about just 2 minutes ago, how is this going when this does come up? What is the impact that I need this information to have at that moment in time? So oftentimes this, how we set up a question is way more important than the actual question we actually ask. So determining when in your cross-examination to ask it, like, do I get them with it right away and just shock the jurors and throw them off? Or do I hold it to the very end and it's my mic drop walk off? Either one, okay. Now, how do I set it up? How do I lead into it? How do I transition out of it? All those things are important, and they're critically important in your role, but they're critically important in job interviews. They're critically important in workplace investigations. They're critically important in discovery conversations. It's a cheesy example, but I was actually, interviewed. I was meeting with a group of executives for a negotiation deal here in Charlotte. And one of the executives went on and on and on about their contract negotiations. Well, I'm not an expert in their contract negotiations, and I'm never going to be. So right. Like for me, I'm listening to her going, okay, she's got to give me something. She's got to give me something that I can just acknowledge. So that way, you know, we're on the same level-ish. Without me having to go into a diatribe about contract negotiations, or I should just pack my stuff up and go, because that's not going to happen. But she started talking about the rounds of edits, and she ended up wrapping up by saying, so really one of the goals we'd love to have is reduce the amount of edit rounds that we go through when we get the contracts back. And I smiled and said, with as few red lines as possible. And she literally looked at the CEO and said, he gets it.
Yeah.
That was one line. There's actually a lot about your contracts I don't get, to be honest. But once I read them, we'll figure it out together. So finding those little pieces makes a huge difference. And the strategic presentation is critical.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And we do spend a lot of time. We organize in particular our cross-examinations into what we call chapters. So we, you know, pick an issue that's important to the case and we create a chapter and we start organizing our questions in each chapter. But then once your chapters are done, then you can kind of move the pieces around and figure out, okay, which chapter is going to work first and how compelling and how does one build on the other? And where do you want to start? What's a good way to really have kind of a big start and a big finish, you know? So that's really important in what we do. And we do spend a lot of time, particularly on cross-examinations, on making sure that they're organized in a way that we are telling the tale that we want the jury or the judge to hear through that series of questions.
I love that point. When you are cross-examining somebody, I've never done it, obviously. When you are cross-examining somebody, I imagine that essentially every time, you're taking somebody who has already given statements in open court, already said things that are on the record. So they've got multiple flags in the sand publicly under the threat of perjury, I guess you could say. And now I'm guessing more often than not, it is your strategy to use the word, cross them up. Maybe there's a contradiction. Maybe there's something that they left out. Maybe there's something that they massaged and we want to unmassage it in front of the jury. So when you are looking at moving somebody away from statements that they have made on the record, what are some of your favorite approaches to walk them through that process in a way that they can't escape?
So it really, you know, it really does kind of depend. So in a global sense, particularly in our medical malpractice work, an expert's coming in and saying your client deviated from the standard of care.
Okay.
So like one of the techniques that we use is to get them to admit all of the things that our client did right. And I'll often start a cross-examination with that. Not every time. I mean, every case is different. But, you know, well, okay, so that you say he deviated from the standard of care and the performance of this surgery. And oftentimes they'll come in and kind of exaggerate the deviation to some extent to influence the jury, right? Yeah. So they kind of make your client sound like they were stupid for the thing that they're contending was done below the standard of care. So if I have one thing that they're really focused on as having been below the standard of care, or maybe even two or three, but the other 50 things that my client did for that patient were done correctly, I just start taking them through, and I won't do all 50. The jury would kill me if I did that, but you know, 10 or 15 steps in the process that were done 100% right. And I've already gotten them to admit that in their deposition. And they've already been sitting in front of the jury and testifying with plaintiff's counsel and didn't criticize any of those steps in the process. Well, let's just go through them and establish exactly all of the things that we did right. And while you're not attacking that necessarily one fine point or two or three fine points that they're making, you're calling them into question because they want people to believe that you're client was an idiot for doing what they did, and yet everything else was perfect, right? So what is the likelihood that he or she was a complete idiot on those one or two, three, five fine points when everything else that they did was good?
I like that approach a lot. It's and especially when you start weighing on like the jury's perception, even if it's just like the scales. I've got 20 things on one. I've got two things on the other. So now, wait a minute, the perception of everything you just said is starting to turn. One of the other things I'm fascinated about with the cross-examination is often in my world, let me rephrase that, often in like the business communication world, we're told on and on and on and on. And you can put me in the list of people that say that to avoid yes or no questions. But in your world, especially in trial, yes or no questions are the majority, or direct questions are the majority of what you're required to ask, I believe. So that way we avoid the leading questions and other problems that could get us in, other questions that could get us into trouble. So if I'm off base, please correct me. If I'm relatively on track, how do you use direct questions to walk somebody down the road to give you the information you require, when most of us are taught to use open questions to do that?
So it's funny. So for cross-examination, we want the yes or no answer, right? We don't want the other party's witnesses having diarrhea of the mouth while we're asking the questions. I want to control that part of the case. Whereas when it's our witnesses, we ask the open-ended questions. So we have to do both in the same setting for different purposes, you know? But for cross-examination, again, if you can start your examination with things that they can't fight you on, like I like with witnesses who tend to talk a lot, I like starting with a series of questions, for example, like what we were just talking about. He did this right. Yes.
Yes, sir.
Get them saying yes, yes, yes. Get them into that kind of pattern of answering questions with one word. And that helps you when you move to the next level. And they might want to fight you a little bit, but they've already gotten into that kind of mantra, which is a great way to start. But we also, if they are going to fight me, I've got to ask the question to get the answer that I know they're probably going to fight me on. And then when they fight me on it, I have to have a piece of evidence that I can hit them over the head with. Yeah. And you do that enough times and they will stop fighting you because they know that you've got something to back up the question that you just asked them. And then they get scared. You know, I've had witnesses go, well, I'll ask them a series of questions. They'll try and fight me and I'll say, okay, well, wait a minute. Here's the deposition that you gave where you said something completely different, or here's a deposition that you gave in a completely different case that I've been able to find and read where you're contradicting what you're saying here. And I've had gotten to the point with witnesses on the witness stand where they go, well, I'm sure that you have where I've said it differently somewhere else. So why don't you just go ahead and show it to me now? Which is always, I mean, a fulfilling, you know, way to enter into that series of questions, because you know you just got them and they're gonna say whatever you want them to say from that point forward. But again, that goes to the preparation, right? That goes to the exhaustive putting together everything and ordering your questions in a way that gets you to the point where you can do that to a witness. It's not something you can walk in and do on the fly.
No, I imagine rarely would an attorney try to wing something like that, but you hear that all the time in sales. You hear it all the time in negotiations where I'm just going to wing it. You know, I'm clever. I've been here before. I have experience. Well, then congratulations. You might fall into the spectrum of what you believe is successful, but what you could have actually achieved by preparing on top of your cleverness and your experience is something entirely different. And even that order of questions that you talked about, I don't know that most people or many, I shouldn't say most, I don't know how many people understand the power of withholding quote unquote evidence, like holding back what you know and not using it until you have to. Is people don't know what you know. And that in and of itself, that's all the way in the back of people's brain. That is waking up gremlins. What do I say? What don't I say? What do they know? What don't they know? And that can work in your favor in so many different ways. But then from a credibility standpoint, with the person themselves, oh, wait, she does know. Oh, wait, she did do her homework. Oh, wait, now I'm not going to be able to get one past her. And in your case, for the jury, or maybe for somebody who's listening, the decision maker, the clients, the end user, the managers, the team, you know, whoever it is, that credibility transmits to everybody. So now in your case, your client's credibility is gaining because of your credibility in front of the room. There's times to do it early. There's times to do it late. And I also imagine that not only are there times where they say, I'm sure you got it, so just show it to me, there might be some times where we hold back a question that we actually don't have the evidence for, because by the time we hit them with that one, we've had the evidence for everything else. So now they just assume we've got the evidence for this one. And the answer is if we had it. I've used that technique in a number of times in my career. One of my favorites was in an investigation where, I'll spare you the long story, but it was a director of consumer marketing who had been rumored to be committing some fraud, but they didn't have any evidence and he was up for a promotion and it was time sensitive and all this stuff. So I go to the location and they tell me all these wonderful things about him. He's a bully. He's arrogant. He's smart. He's all of these, you know, the person you'd love to speak with, right? One of the guys just made a comment that if they do lose him, it would be unfortunate because he just rolled out this new ladder marketing strategy. And I was like, oh, what's that? And they tell me, no, I've got nothing. I have zero evidence going in to interrogate this guy. So when I sit down in front of him, we're doing the whole build rapport thing, which in that environment, you know, verify your employee number and how do I spell your last name and just little things, right, to get the conversation started. So when he gave me his name, I paused. And I was like, Brian, dude, ladder strategy, that was you. And he looked at me like my dog when I won't give her the treat. Like, what? That was all I had. But now he's got to start thinking, if he knows that random fact, what else does he know?
Mm-hmm.
Which, for the record, was nothing, but it worked well. It served its purpose by the end of the conversation when we had our written statement. What I think is amazing is I'm listening to you talk about this, and I think you mentioned it a little bit before, is you are, maybe if I'm using the word correctly, vicariously telling a story. So
yeah,
you have the story that you want told, but you have to ask somebody else questions to get them to tell you the story you want in the order you want to do it. So talk about reverse engineering a story, and you illustrated when it's your client, that's probably a little bit more straightforward. You get to practice it, rehearse it. You're asking the questions to lead them to it. But under cross-examination, it's an entirely different process. So I'm curious to the art that goes behind that. I'm going to use my questions to get somebody else to tell the story that I want. You mentioned a little bit, holding back the evidence, thinking about the order of questions, those kinds of things. How right am I to assume that strategically you start with the story first, and then once you have the story or the narrative that you want, then you start working backwards through the questions and statements you think you need to make to get that story told the way you want it told?
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of the story. The way that I usually get ready for trial is I put a whiteboard up in my office or a flip chart, and I draw a line down the middle, and I have one side that's good facts and one side that's bad facts. And I try with the evidence that we have available to either neutralize the bad facts or turn them into a good fact for us if we can. And so we, on that whiteboard, have the citations for each piece of evidence that supports either side, and then try and figure out whether or not I want to use it, how I want to use it. So it is kind of the story. It's more the facts that we need, that we think are either really good for us or really bad for us within the story, I guess, is probably the best way to say that. But, and then from there, those good facts and bad facts kind of form the basis for our chapters that we use. And then within the chapters, we start asking the questions based upon the evidence that we know that we have for the facts that are on the board.
I love it. And I love how the chapters break down and fit your story narrative perfect. Like, we've got chapters within the story. Hearing the breakdown between good facts and bad facts, I think, is amazing. How safe am I to assume that a good fact is something that helps you and a bad fact is something that could work against your case?
100%. Yeah.
Okay. So they're facts. They're true in the context that you're operating. A good fact is one that could help you, and a bad fact is one that could work against you. I love the concept of embracing the bad facts right out of the gate. Like, we're not ignoring them. We're not wishing them away. We're not trying to steer clear of them, because inevitably they're going to come up, probably, if Murphy's Law runs your life the way it runs mine, at the worst possible opportunity. So embracing them from the beginning and saying, okay, here's what we think we got on our side. Here's what we think could pretty easily work against us. So now let's figure out how to flip them, how to neutralize them, how to try to use them to our advantage. So that thought process of taking advantage of bad facts, I think, is spectacular. If you had to say, going into that strategic process, do you believe you spend more time prioritizing using the good facts or addressing the bad facts?
I think I spend more time trying to neutralize or flip a bad fact. Trying to figure that out, because the good facts are always going to be good. And we talk about them in terms of, you know, good facts are also facts generally that can't be changed. Like, there's nothing anybody's ever going to be able to say or do that's going to get rid of that. Sure. Whereas bad facts, sometimes you can flip. So for example, in this last case that I just finished trying a week ago, the plaintiff's entire theory was that our client's documentation and an operative note was insufficient. And as a result, subsequent care for the patient was less than ideal because people didn't really understand what had happened when our client did the surgery that he did. My client's operative note was terrible. It was not a good operative note, but we were able to establish through other facts that the later care providers didn't rely on the note. So we could neutralize one of their entire allegations of negligence by just establishing factually that people down the road didn't even look at the note. So it didn't matter. which they knew because they had deposed the people who had taken care of the patient down the line. And they were ignoring that bad fact for them. And they focused way too much on the documentation part of the case as a result, because they didn't like that bad fact for them, which was that nobody admitted that they had ever even looked at that record.
Yeah.
So that's just an example.
And as I draw a little bit of thinking back to my previous life, an investigative kind of parallel to that, that feels like scenarios where people try to fit the outcome they want to the perception that they have. So instead of looking at the facts and saying, okay, what really happened here? And even if that's up for debate in the legal system, what really happened here and how do we address that? Instead, it's, well, here's what I need this to look like. So I'm going to focus on fitting the story together as opposed to actually addressing the fact. I'm going to make some other guesses here, and I'd be happy for you to tell me how wrong I am once again. So you and Trish, or you and your team, you get it on the flip chart, the whiteboard, you're looking at the bad facts and you see the note, you're like, well, that really actually is a pretty terrible note. So is the next line of questioning amongst yourselves something along the line of, okay, that's a bad note. That probably could be used against us. There's really no getting around the fact that that note is lacking some details that'd be nice to have. How are they going to try to use that against us? What do you think is the outcome they're going to try to create with that note? Okay, so the note is what it is, but here's how they're most likely going to try to use it. So if that's how they're going to try to use it, what do we need to do either before or after they do that in order to erase that effort, regardless of what the note says?
Yeah, I mean, we spend a lot of time on that. We spend a lot of time in that particular case preparing our client to say, yeah, I mean, it wasn't a great note. And here's why. And I can explain why it wasn't great. You know, I was on call that weekend. It was the 4th of July weekend. We were very busy. You know, I've got to get something in the record before I leave the hospital. And yeah, his injury was pretty bad, but he was stable. He wasn't bleeding. He's not, you know, there. He was going to be okay that day, but I had a call about another lady who needed emergent surgery at another hospital that was 20 minutes away, and I got to go. So, you know, we had ways to kind of neutralize it a little bit while still acknowledging that it wasn't great, right? Like, one of our mantras in our office is first liar always loses. Always. And so we don't ever want to take a fact and either completely ignore it if it's bad for us, because if you do that, it's going to get bigger than it actually is, right? Or we don't want to stretch the truth, much less to say something that's not true. So we can't just ignore those things. We've got to figure out a way to deal with them. And so, you know, it's really important to make sure that you're covering all of that and bouncing it around the team. I mean, I am well known for taking holes around the office where I go and I sit in everybody's office and I'm like, okay, here's this. How does that hit you? What do you think we could do with that? How would you address that fact if it was your case, you know? And often with people who are not working on the case, haven't heard anything about it really yet, so that I get kind of a really fresh, almost like a juror or judge perspective on how to address that particular issue.
A couple of places I want to go after listening to that. I do love polling the team. And I think that that's something a lot of, like, taking it out of your context, leaders could learn a lot from. Because at the top of the organization, whether we want to admit it or not, we don't have our finger on the pulse of everything that's going on around us. The people below us on the org chart do. So we might think we know, and we might have known 6 months ago, we might have known 2 years ago, but the world is a fast-moving and fast-changing pace. So getting those insights and those opportunities from unsuspecting or sometimes undervalued or unrealized people and resources is an extremely important approach. So congratulations to you for actually embracing that. You mentioned judge and jury, and I want to separately, and I want to kind of go back and touch on that in just a minute. But before I do, I love that line. First liar always loses. I think conceptually, I understand what you mean by that, especially after you reinforce the importance of always telling the truth and sticking to the truth so it doesn't come back to you. But especially in the context you operate in, why does the first liar always lose? I said that wrong. It all ends. Let me say that again. Why does the first liar always lose? Hi, my name is Mike Reddington, and sometimes I speak English.
There you go. You spoke earlier about the importance of credibility and, you know, gaining credibility with the questions that you ask. And in a courtroom in particular, the credibility of the speaker is hugely important. I mean, if you're known for going before judges and citing case law to them, that then when the court goes and reads the case and goes, that's not what that case says, your credibility as the lawyer not only is gone for that case, it's gone for every other case that you're going to appear in front of that judge on until you can reestablish your credibility. So it's hugely important. I think, you know, I don't think that judge or that juries rule for parties generally based upon who their lawyer is. But in a close case, they are going to go with the side that they trust. And when I say first liar always loses, it's not even just outright misrepresenting something that you know you're misrepresenting. I mean, not knowing your record, not knowing what's in the evidence that is going to be presented at trial. And it goes back to that kind of exhaustive preparation and knowing literally every single page, because sometimes people say something because they don't know better. In fact, in this last case that I tried, the lawyer asked, one of the lawyers on the other side asked a question that made it sound like my client had altered a piece of evidence during the discovery phase of the trial, or of the case, before we were in the courtroom. And I objected. We went up to the bench. I said to the judge, I said, you know, we have ethics rules that are in play here. You have to have a good faith basis, either in fact or in law, for asking a question that you ask of a witness. Because if you're asking completely unfair questions, that witness literally has nowhere to go. You know, most witnesses should know if they're being asked something that's factually untrue. But, you know, they're not used to sitting in a box in front of 12 strangers who are staring at them. All the lawyers sitting at counsel table are staring at them. The judge is up above them, staring down at them. It's an incredibly intimidating place to be. So even if they know it, they don't. And you've prepped them for it, they still don't always know how to deal with the situation. So, you know, to me, even just making minor misrepresentations because you don't know the record also destroys your credibility. So again, it goes back to preparation. I can't say it enough. I mean, and that's what we spend so much of our time doing is preparing.
That preparation is so important, but it's not just preparing for the sake of preparation. It's right. Here's the outcome. Here are the problems that we need to solve. Here's the story that we need to tell. Here are the roadblocks. Here might be the emergency exits that we need. Like here are, so it's strategic and purposeful preparation that, that really makes the difference. Earlier, you talked about communicating in front of a judge versus communicating in front of a jury. Kind of separate those for a minute. Hopefully I remember to come back to the judge. We'll start with the jury. I think about having to often persuade one person. Maybe in a business agreement situation, it's two or three. But by and large, those people function as one. They made enough decisions together over a period of time that they know what they're looking for. They've done it before. So for all intents and purposes, it's generally persuading one person. How do you strategically craft, for lack of a better word, arguments to try to persuade 12 different human beings simultaneously?
Yeah. And it is all 12 because our juries, at least in North Carolina, have to render their verdict unanimously. So I don't look at it necessarily as persuading all 12. I look at it as persuading a core group within the jury that then takes the message and the evidence that I've kind of laid out for them. And I'm relying on them to some extent to persuade the balance of the group, mm-hmm. right? So it's not necessarily that I look at it as I'm always the one who's persuaded all 12. Oftentimes it's my four person who, you know, we don't know who the four person is going to be. We generally kind of take bets on it, maybe. that's what we're focused on, is trying to convince just a core group of people, particularly for the defense, because I also consider it a win if they can't convince all 12, but they got 8 and I got 4. I've still not gotten a verdict against my client at the end of the day, right? It's considered a mistrial. It's not necessarily the outcome that we want, but we haven't lost.
Yes.
So for the defense side, that's important. You know, for the plaintiff side, they have to convince all 12. I technically only have to convince one who's willing to hold on tight and not give in.
Don't let go. Don't let go. I'm sure as part of that process, reading the room, so to speak, is a lot of what you and your team do. And I'm guessing it's reading the room while your side has the mic, so to speak, when you're in control of what's being said in the court, and also reading the room when the plaintiff side is. How are people reacting, responding to that? So kind of a double barrel question here. Are there particular techniques that you and your team really rely on when reading the room? And with those, is there a way you try to determine who that core group within the jury is that you really need to influence without being in the jury room with them?
So when I'm questioning witnesses, I don't look at the jury. I'm very focused on the witness that I'm working with. I will sometimes on direct examination look at the jury because I have more time while my witness is giving a narrative response to see mm-hmm. how the jury is responding to that testimony. But on cross-examination, I just can't. It's so intensive and I'm so focused on making sure that my rhythm is good. I mean, like all sorts of things. But my team is there with me. And so they know that if they feel like I'm making a juror mad, if a juror looks angry, if I've got somebody who's falling asleep, whatever the case may be, they slip me a note. So everybody on our side is trying to pay attention, right? When I'm asking the questions, they definitely need to be focused on the jury to make sure that if something's going, looks like it might be going awry, they let me know. when the plaintiff is asking questions, you know, we look at the jury. Some jurors are very stoic. They don't give you anything. You can't tell what the heck they're thinking. Other jurors are very demonstrative. We've had jurors cry. We've had jurors fall asleep. We've had jurors nodding their heads like crazy. I tend to be a nodder when I'm, you know, anytime anybody's speaking to me, I'm kind of, oh yeah, oh, okay. Whether I agree with you or not, I'm a nodder. So I don't necessarily take a lot from that. I do take a lot from if a juror physically turns themselves so that their back is almost to counsel table that's asking the questions. And generally that would be plaintiff's counsel because they're closest to the jury. If I'm seeing that, I'm feeling really good as a defense lawyer. You know, if I see people with their arms like crossed and they're like backing up, they're not accepting the message that you're offering to them if they're like that, you know, unless it's, you know, 50 degrees in the room and they're just cold, you know, little thing. I mean, but you need to take all of that into account and pay attention to all of those things to kind of give you some of that feedback. Judges will do the same thing. You know, they'll be listening and then all of a sudden maybe they'll lean back in their chair and kind of be bouncing on their seat a little bit. Like, okay, I'm done with this. Like, I'm good. I don't need to hear this anymore. So there are little cues that you can pick up for sure. I think I told you before we came on this last case that I tried, literally me, the judge, and jurors had our heads in our hands as opposing counsel was giving his closing argument that went on perhaps a wee bit too long. Read the room. Like, if everybody's doing that, nobody's listening to you anymore. They're just saying within their own head, when is this going to be over?
Yeah. Is obviously, I can't speak for that person, and the details are none mine or nobody's listening's business. Often, if we have overprepared to say something, or if we're nervous about what we are going to say, or if we haven't given ourselves, I like to think of it sometimes almost as like a band on stage has a set list. They don't have all the lyrics. They don't have all the notes. They might probably don't even have the full titles of the songs on stage anywhere. They've just got a word from the title of each song so they can look down and they know where to go. So if we're over-prepared or we're focusing on the details, then we're never going to be able to read the room because our mind is now too focused, target fixation on the thing in front of us and not the thing around us. And when you talked about even the cross and the arms, I love how you illustrated, you brought up the cold room after, but it's not just the cross and the arms, it's turning the back. Mm-hmm. It's not just crossing the arms, it's physically leaning away. They might be crossing their arms because their back hurts. It's cold in the room. The jury box chairs are ridiculously uncomfortable. Like, there's all of these reasons why they could be crossing their arms. But when they turn their back to the person who is speaking, or when they lean away and make a disgusted face, like, now you're really starting to narrow down the number of likely triggers that would have caused that behavior, because you're reading that cluster and you're putting it together in the context of the situation. So very important distinction there. You did mention judges. For a lot of people, I mean, this could be kids talking to parents. This could be employees, managers talking to senior leaders. In some ways, this could be your average citizen talking to law enforcement. What are some of the most productive techniques you've learned to have a persuasive professional conversation with somebody who essentially has absolute power in that setting?
So deference, whether you want to give deference or not, whether you feel like they're really entitled to deference or not, whether you think there really is a valid argument against you or not, takes you a long way. So I always have a lot of deference for judges, regardless of who the judge is. And try very hard not to have what I'm not very good at, which is a poker face. I don't have a good poker face. I will roll my eyes. I will, you know, which is hard. I try very hard particularly when you're just in front of the judge to not do any of that. Mm-hmm. It's hard sometimes. Sometimes it's really hard when you think that a court really is not getting it or is getting it wrong, or they just don't want to make a decision, because it's easier not to, and there's no risk in not making the decision. Yes. So, other than that, you try and have mutual respect and you try to understand that, your credibility and your professional reputation within the judicial system is based upon how you conduct yourself in front of those judges. And if anybody thinks that those judges are getting off the bench and not mentioning your name outside of that courtroom, you are dead flat wrong about that. They all talk to each other. All of the judges in a particular courthouse are all talking to each other about the lawyers that are appearing in front of them, whether they can trust them, how long they go on and on and on. Should they cut them off? Can they believe what they say when it comes to the law? Can they believe what they say when it comes to the facts? Because those are two very different things. So, all of those things come into play and you do the best that you can to present everything in a way that is truthful, respectful, and persuasive. I mean, that's all you can do. And again, organizing your argument for the judge is just as important as organizing your cross-examination for a witness. Like, where do you start? How do you start? Is really important.
I bet it is. And I'm sure once you and your team have been working together for a long time, but once somebody begins to have experience with a certain judge, then you can start to learn how that case needs to be organized and presented in front of that judge, just like anybody would learn how a case needs to, or an idea needs to be organized and presented in front of a customer or in front of their manager, or sometimes even in front of your husband or wife, maybe.
But hope, yes, you would hope that people would learn that.
Yes. Pay attention to those things. They matter. I almost cut you off. I love that recipe. Truthful, respectful, and persuasive. I love that recipe. I think that works really well. And I think talking about understanding the power, I've tried to work with, I have a young son, and I've tried helping him understand reputation calls. Like, once people see a certain amount of behavior, whether that represents who you really are or not, they start making assumptions based on reputation that drive their decisions. And sometimes it can take a lot longer to unwind those reputations than it did to accidentally have them created on our behalf.
It's so important. I don't think that judges necessarily talk about other lawyers with other lawyers. I mean, they definitely do with other judges, but I mean, your opposing counsel is going to talk about you. They're going to talk about you on podcasts. I mean, like, you know, those are tales. Those are part of what we do. It's part of how we learn. It's how I convey to other lawyers what to do and what not to do. You know, I mean, I think we talked briefly before we came on. I'm a huge proponent of people going and watching what other lawyers do in the courtroom. And, you know, thankfully we're trying cases in person now in North Carolina. So you can go down and you can watch lawyers argue. You can watch opening statements. You can watch closing arguments. You can watch them examine witnesses. It's a tremendous way to learn. So if you're standing up in a courtroom and people are observing you, they're going to leave and they're going to talk about you. So again, I mean, that goes to your reputation, your professional reputation. If they see you do something that's questionably unethical, you know, I mean, that's going to hurt you in the long run. You don't want that.
All extremely valid points. And I imagine that for all of those people who are watching you when you're in court, you're the only person for them to watch. All the spotlights are on you. You are the one driving the question, asking the questions, driving the conversations. There are people watching the jury's reaction. I'm sure there are plenty of people watching your reaction from the other side. Like, ooh, is that what she wanted? Was that a surprise? Was she planning on that? Does her reaction tip me off on something she might do later? Like, so all of these things. And earlier, it didn't escape me that you mentioned your delivery and your rhythm when you're in front of the courtroom. And to bring this full circle, all of that goes back to preparation. Mm-hmm. How can we concentrate on our tone, our pacing, our rhythm, our posture, our reactions, facial expressions, all of these things that add to the experience we want the judge and jury to see if we're not well enough prepared for everything else that we have to say and do?
I mean, literally down to if I've got to hand something to the witness. You know, if we're not in a courtroom that's electronic, you know, or even if we are, how do I get that piece of evidence to the witness in a quick, organized, crisp? I don't want any fumbling. I don't want any bumbling. I don't want any tripping. I don't want to have to turn around and dig through a box unless I've planned for that to be part of the drama in front of the jury, right? So sometimes you want to dig through something because it gives a message of some sort. But most of the time, I have everything in order, ready to go. If I'm using an electronic system to present evidence, I know exactly which page I need to go to. I have an image in my outline of my questions of which portion of the document I want to highlight for the jury and call out on the screen. Like, I mean, it is a choreographed process when done correctly.
Thank you for forcing me to figure out how to spell choreograph.
You're very welcome.
I really appreciate that. Whatever I just wrote down is not how you spell choreograph.
Dance moves.
You've been extremely gracious with your time. There's one more question I'd like to ask, if you don't mind. You talked a little bit about preparing your witnesses, which, and you talked about the stress, the bright lights, the intimidation that comes with sitting in that box while they're up there. Really what you're doing is coaching, I think is a fair way to say. I don't think there's anything
absolutely
about saying it that way. So you are coaching people to perform in unique environments under extreme stress. Mm-hmm. We probably could have framed a whole conversation about this now that I'm thinking about it. So way to go, Mike. We're going to have you back on that. We didn't even get into depositions or all kinds of other stuff.
I know, right?
But just to touch on the coaching piece really quick, what have you found to be some of your more effective approaches, techniques for coaching people to be successful and stick to the plan under very stressful, novel circumstances?
So I do my best to try to take the stress off of them. So if you can get somebody into a frame of mind where they understand that they can neither win nor lose the entire case based upon their performance sitting on that witness stand, it takes a little bit of the stress off of them. So I try and prepare them first on, these are the only things that you could say that would lose this case for us. So in a medical malpractice case, if the defendant doctor gets up there and says, you're right, I deviated from the standard of care, I didn't use my best judgment, I was not reasonable or diligent in my care of this patient, you lose. So we start off from that perspective and say, okay, do you believe that you were reasonable? Do you believe that you used your best judgment? Why do you believe that? What are the things in the record that support your thought process on that? Do we have evidence for that? So you kind of build them up a little bit on those things and say, okay, so you're never going to say one of those things. So no matter what you say, we have a chance to win this case so long as you don't say those three things, and you're not going to say them because you don't believe they're true. So we're good. Like literally we're good. Like just remember that and take a breath anytime you're freaking out up there. Just, we often will tell people who are really, really nervous, I want both of your feet on the floor while you're answering questions. Don't cross your legs. Don't cross your arms. Put your hands, you know, if there are arms on the chair, put your arms on the arms of the chair, put both feet on the ground and just breathe. Like that, it's a, you know, simple little cues like that. And then know your record. I mean, they have to be as prepared on the record, on their record, as we are on the record. So making sure that you're feeding them the information that they need to feel like they have all of the knowledge that they need to answer questions and make sure that they're not saying something that is inconsistent with what's in the record.
I love it. Take the stress off of them. You can't sink this ship. Well, you could, but you're not going to.
And they come to that on their own, right? Yeah. Like it's not even you're forcing that on them. They need to come to that themselves to really feel good about it.
That's a good point. So take the stress off of them. Make sure they know their record. They're comfortable with their piece. And even that little thing about keeping both feet on the floor and both hands on the chair, the nervous energy is like lightning. It's going to find its fastest way to the ground. So that helps keep all of that in perspective. A long time ago, I was the only one in the room. Well, I guess there's many times I'm the only one in the room laughing, which says something about me. But in one particular case, I was at an event here in Charlotte, and there was somebody from the city speaking about like initiatives. And they happened to be talking about money they were sinking into the sports teams, Panthers and Hornets and all this stuff. And a guy raises his hand, and I happen to catch it on my peripheral vision. And the guy who raised his hands did it with a look of disdain on his face. And like the kid in the back of class that's had the right answer all along and feels disrespected that nobody else has had it. So now my curiosity is piqued. Like, oh, what's he going to ask? So when the speaker calls on, the speaker is sitting behind a podium, I should tell you. So when the speaker calls on this guy, the guy in a, honestly, like a, he asked a fair question, but he asked it in a disgusted tone of voice. Basically, all this money is going into sports. What about the arts? And when he asked it that way, the podium has a microphone on it. The guy standing behind the podium got so unnerved by the delivery of the question that when he shifted his feet, he kicked the podium. Because the podium had a mic on it, it made this big boom sound. And I watched people like look at each other, like try to figure out what the boom was. And now I'm laughing twice because clearly the speaker was unprepared and unnerved by that question. And how did these people around me not realize what just happened?
Yeah.
By keeping your hands on the chair and by keeping your feet on the floor, nervous energy to the ground. You talked about rhythm before. You create that rhythm in your responses, and that rhythm helps create calm, helps you find your memories and stay on track.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It is crazy how people end up in those situations not as prepared as they should be.
Yes, it all you had one job.
That's right.
You had That's one right. job. You knew you were going to be there. It's not a surprise. There's a lot riding on this. I need to let you go, but I wonder how much time people spend focusing on their fears as opposed to their outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Here are all the things I'm worried about happening or that I don't want to happen. So if I just focus on them long enough, I'll make sure they actually happen. Versus if I just clearly define the outcomes I want to achieve and embrace the process necessary to achieve those outcomes, probably make sure those things happen too.
Yeah. And there goes all that nervous energy. You won't have it because you have
hard work's
good
already done.
Yeah. That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah.
You've been amazing. Thank you so much. I could ask you easily another hour worth of questions.
We can totally geek out on all of this all the time. Yes.
Thank you. I'm going to hold you to that. We're going to do it again. I've absolutely enjoyed this. I've misspelled at least one of my notes, probably several more, but I've been taking notes the whole time. For people who have been listening and they're interested in you and your team and your work, where can they go to find out more about you?
LincolnDurr.com. That's us. That's, from there they can get to all of our social media and everything else. So, even if you just Google Sarah Lincoln, I think Lincoln Durr is the first thing that comes up. So
awesome. And there you have your blog and your news and your podcast. And so there's plenty of content there besides this is why we're awesome. And these are the cases that we win.
Correct. So
there's lots for people to learn there.
Yep. Yep. And easy to find. The website's pretty easy to navigate. So
awesome. Well, thank you so much, Sarah. I really do appreciate you sharing your time and all of your stories, experiences, and expertise. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
You got to stay safe. We'll talk to you soon. Sarah, thank you for a wonderful conversation. I'm grateful for you taking the time out of your schedule to join us today. And thank you so much for all of the wisdom that you shared with us. That line, "the first liar loses," I found entertaining, valuable, and educational all at the same time. That is one that I will always remember. The first liar loses. I also really appreciated how you talked about coaching people's frame of mind. So especially when you're working with witnesses on your side, not just coaching them through what to say and what the experience is going to be like and how to answer questions, but really preparing their frame of mind so that way they can better deal with whatever they encounter while they're on the stand in deposition or otherwise. I really thought that was a great piece of advice that we all can apply. The importance of earning and maintaining credibility, and of course, showing strategic deference. I think sometimes that's something that might hit people the wrong way when you mentioned it in dealing with the judges, but often when we show strategic deference, it's not necessarily laying down for somebody, but it's setting up the opportunity to be more influential or persuasive at a critical moment, continuing to earn that credibility and develop the relationship. So I appreciate you saying that as well. Thank you so much for all that you shared with us today. And thank you to everybody that took the time to join us today. I always appreciate you being here. Thank you for sharing another hour. Hopefully you've got another page full of notes and ideas and perspectives that can help you with your conversations as well. Thank you. Before we go, let's thank our sponsors one more time, HumanTel. Head over to HumanTel.com. Enter the code INCUASIVE25 for 25% off their best-in-class self-paced online training. If you've ever wanted to develop the skill of knowing what people are likely thinking and feeling by recognizing their shifting facial expressions and body language in real time, then I highly recommend heading over to HumanTel.com and enter the code INCUASIVE25 for the online training of your choice, 25% off, the online training of your choice after you check out all of their research, all of their writing, and decide which one is best for you. For the professional interviewers, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can learn more about the International Association of Interviewers, all of their resources, all of the networking, all of the educational events, all of the qualifications, team level, individual level, all of the contribution opportunities. It's there, certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can also learn more about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation, what it takes to qualify, how you pass the exam, what you need to do to maintain the designation, and all the things that it can mean for your career moving forward. And finally, while you're online, please check out Inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to customize for their senior leadership team, their business development teams, their HR teams, and beyond, to teach them how to apply the strategic observation and persuasion skills necessary in order to encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences, which is something many of us do all day long. And when done properly, can uncover hidden value that leads to outcomes in relationships we've previously struggled to attain. All of that and more at Inquasive.com. Please, before you head out, like the show, share the show, give us your feedback, subscribe on your favorite platform. We really appreciate you being here week after week. Thank you so very much. Please stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.